Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher.
There it goes there. Now firing onto the crowd. Out!
Unrest in Ferguson, Missouri has raised awareness of an apparent militarization of local police departments. For more than 20 years, many local police forces around the nation have benefited from a hand-me-down weapons program established by the Pentagon, commonly known as the 1033 program. It allows the transfer of military equipment to local law enforcement. But that's not the only reason why law enforcement organizations across the country have upped the game. Joining us now by phone to talk about that is a professor of criminal justice and director of the School of Community Affairs at Wichita State University, Michael Berzer. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Also with us is the chief of the Columbus Division of Police, Kim Jacobs. Welcome to the show, Chief.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, too.
Michael Berzer, how common is it for suburbs like Ferguson or even Worthington, Ohio, to have military-grade weapons and equipment like this? What do we know about that in general?
Well, it's become increasingly common over the last 20 or 30 years. And, you know, a lot of this really stemmed out from 1981 when Congress passed the Military Cooperation Act with law enforcement agencies. And basically that was encouragement for them to become closer partners with military, and much of the equipment and training then with the military. And it just exacerbated, you know, I think, over the course of the years. And, of course, as we got into the 80s and the drug war was on full-fledged, I think then you started seeing more use of tactical equipment in executing drug search warrants and in many communities as well. So yes, it's certainly exacerbated over the years.
So in 1981, so it was beyond the exacerbated issue, it was sort of triggered by the quote-unquote war on drugs. Otherwise, why would they think about even linking the military with local police?
You know, I think that was, you know, the thrust was during the drug war. However, if you back up and you look at the history of the American police, you'll find that what we call the political era, just shortly after the 20th century into the 1930s, there was a lot of corruption within American police agencies. So as we had some major police reformers in the 30s and 40s, 50s, and 60s begin to bring the military model more so into policing just as a way to organize policing, to get command and control. And it was thought that, you know, police officers would obey and follow rules and regulations and orders. So, you know, in one sense, it started out with, you know, good intents, but has just, you know, basically exacerbated itself over the course of time.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. You just heard from Michael Berzer. He's a professor of criminal justice and director of the School of Community Affairs at Wichita State University. Also with me in the studio is Kim Jacobs, chief of the Columbus Division of Police. We're talking about the apparent militarization of local police forces across the country, something that's been reflected in a lot of what we've seen from Ferguson, Missouri in recent weeks. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Chief, from where you sit, is that do you hear what Professor Berzer is saying, and does that make sense in terms of your experience with on a police force and as a chief?
I would say I can only speak for local. And in late 1990s, there was a robbery that happened out in Los Angeles area. The police were totally outgunned. And subsequent to that, I think that many agencies, and I remember the conversation I was, you know, working with the division at that time. What can we do about making sure that we have equal firepower or greater firepower than some of the suspects that have made themselves known? Those suspects in that robbery were wearing body armor. And they had rifles, and they were shooting people, and the police were not able to take them down for quite some time. So I remember the conversations, and we thought that we needed to have rifles in our division to be able to deal with such situations. We had shotguns, but they're not accurate at long distances. So we wanted to make sure that we had those. And that's when our division started looking at getting some of the military surplus rifles to better arm our own personnel. So for many, many years, we used that surplus for just rifles and computers as a way to save the city some money, the taxpayers some money, but to get the equipment that we needed, and because it was available and it was free, it made a lot of sense.
Was the episode in Los Angeles, though, obviously a much different city than Columbus, particularly back then, but was it seen as an aberration or something that was Columbus, the Columbus force had experienced but had not seen what they could do about it?
At that time, we hadn't seen too many suspects that were wearing body armor.
Right.
But it was becoming more and more available to public people. So therefore, even though it might have been an aberration in the country at that time, that mm-hmm. doesn't mean that it wouldn't happen again, because a lot of people take what worked with somebody else and then follow through. But you never want to be unprepared. So that's when we first started realizing that maybe we could use that program to get the type of weapons that we thought would be necessary at some point in time, but not to the point where we thought that they would be overwhelming. We understand that the citizens will approve or disapprove those things that we use to police. I mean, we police at their will. So we have not had any negative feedback about the rifles. Our officers are trained. They qualify every year with them. And we believe that we have been able to deal with some situations because of the access to the rifles.
You and I talked about the semantics of a lot of this weaponry and the vehicles and so forth. And Michael Berzer, I was wondering if you could start and speak to that issue, because when I mentioned to Chief Jacobs about the assault rifles, she said, well, we call them patrol rifles. We don't call them assault rifles. Let's talk about the semantics for a moment and how that's evolved over time, Michael Berzer.
Oh, sure. And first, let me just dovetail off of something the chief said that, you know, I fully understand that, you know, from a police operational standpoint, they have to be prepared because they never really know what they're going to be up against from call to call. So I think you have to have, you know, those reserves in place in the event you have something as tragic as Los Angeles or other events. But I think the problem now is we've had departments that have went overboard and incorporated that into everyday policing activities. And, you know, unfortunately, a lot of those activities end up in, you know, impoverished communities. And then again, many of those impoverished communities happen to be communities of color, which already have a lot of strained relationships. So, again, I think by doing that, by making it a part of the culture, creates a lot of problems in the end. Going back to your question, Anne, I think certainly, I mean, the terms that are used now for weaponry, I mean, just the general military terms that you find in policing across the board, things like, you know, chain of command, centralized command structure, a tactical command structure. I mean, these are all, you know, directly from, you know, military, from the military operations. And, you know, policing obviously is a paramilitary organization, in as much that they borrow a lot of those terms over. And there's been a lot of, you know, discussion here recently about maybe beginning to move away from those paramilitary institutions and maybe model policing more like, you know, a corporate model. And that was discussed a lot with the community policing movement back in the 70s and in, you know, into the 80s and 90s.
And what
as
do you
well.
Mean by a corporate model?
A corporate model is where you begin to, you know, maybe rethink your, you know, command, your rank structure within an organization. And even some of the great reformers of the American policing, O.W. Wilson, great police reformer in the 30s and 40s, who initially thought that organizing police departments along military lines was one way to control it, to get rid of the rampant corruption that, you know, existed at that time. However, in his later writings, he began to realize that there were drastic differences between the military role and the police role. And so he advocated going to like a service officer, 1, 2, 3, and you do that by basically Roman numerals. Like if it's a Roman numeral 1, you were at the bottom level. And so as you get up the managerial rank, you become a larger Roman numeral, basically. So you would get rid of, you know, the ranks, sergeants, captains, lieutenants, which, you know, of course are borrowed from the military. And then you get, you know, you can look at, you know, what does that really mean in policing? Well, in the military, at the rank of a sergeant, you're a non-commissioned officer. Rank of a lieutenant, you're a commissioned officer in the military. Policing, that's non-existent. So from a sergeant, lieutenant, and captain, that just doesn't apply.
Chief Jacobs, what about that, the semantics and how they apply to not only the weaponry, but how the force is organized and what that communicates to the public you serve?
Well, I haven't, again, heard any negatives associated with naming our ranks a certain thing.
It's a tradition.
And we very clearly identify ourselves as a paramilitary organization. I mean, that's historic, I guess is the best way to put it. But that's not our philosophy of policing. Our philosophy of policing is really about being community-minded. And I, you know, someday those semantics might change with regard to how we identify ourselves to the public. I know that I get addressed as officer all the time. You know, they don't call me by my rank necessarily, and that's been throughout my 35-year career. They recognize our authority because we wear the uniform, and we are distinguishable from the public in that way. To take care of some of the situations that we are sent to and or called to, I think we need to have that authority apparent. And oftentimes the public is looking for a supervisor to address a question to. So I don't see the rank structure as being a problem. It's really about your philosophy of how you get along with your community.
We talked about the 1033 program a little while ago, and the Columbus Police have benefited from patrol rifles and computers. Beyond that, can you tell us what sort of equipment the force does use? We've seen these big tanks in Ferguson. Tell us about what you do have that a lot of people would probably associate with the military.
Another one of the things that we've benefited from is getting binoculars, good binoculars. And then the military decides whether or not they're going to give us their best equipment or not. So we've had to send some back after they recalled them. So that's been the majority of it. We had a very conservative policy for many years, and it was just computers and rifles. And then we expanded it. Prior to my tenure as chief, it was expanded. We started accumulating more things, more vehicles. In fact, we even got 6 Humvees for a period of time. But when we analyzed whether or not those were going to be beneficial to us, we realized that the cost of getting them upfitted with good bulletproof glass, because they could not guarantee that, the maintenance, all of those things did not have a good return on investment.
Mm-hmm.
Even though they were free, they were going to cost us.
Right.
So we actually sent them back to the military. So we've been going back into a very, very conservative mode. We had some issues with our program, and we've straightened those out. And now we're only going to take things in that we have an identified need for. And that's the way that it should be, in my opinion.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We'll continue our conversation. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Since its inception in 1991, the Pentagon's 1033 program has doled out over $4 billion in military equipment to local police forces across the country. Critics of the program say there's not enough government oversight of police departments that receive the equipment. In the wake of continued unrest in Ferguson, Missouri, Department of Defense spokesman John Kirby addressed this issue.
Many citizens of many towns and cities all over the country have benefited from it. But how, as I said before, how and where and under what circumstances the equipment actually gets used is up to local law enforcement agencies to determine.
You just heard from Columbus Chief of the Columbus Division of Police, Kim Jacobs. She told us that the Columbus Division of Police has received equipment from the Pentagon through that program, mostly rifles, computers, binoculars, and in the past, vehicles. But they've been returned because they weren't worth the investment it would take to upgrade them for use in the force's work. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. Still with us by phone is Michael Berzer of Wichita State University, where he's director of the School of Community Affairs and professor of criminal justice. Obviously, Chief Kim Jacobs is with us in the studio. And joining us now is the chief lobbyist for the American Civil Liberties Union of Ohio, Gary Daniels. Welcome back, Gary.
Thanks, Sam.
This Pentagon program provides surplus military equipment to local police forces to help fight terrorism, drug trafficking, whatever they deem it's necessary to use it for. How often do situations like that actually arise on the local level, according to this study that the ACLU completed in June?
Mm-hmm. Yes, we released a study in June called War Comes Home, the Excessive Militarization of American Police. And what we did is we sent out 260 public records requests around the country to 25 different law enforcement agencies in 25 different states in the District of Columbia, and found out where some of this weaponry and equipment is going, what it's being used for. But I think it's also important to remember, because a lot of people seem to be focusing very much when they talk about militarization of police on the equipment, and particularly such things, very visible, visceral things such as anti-mine vehicles. But it's about much more than that. It's also about SWAT teams and how we use them and how we deploy them. It's about the training that police receive, and it's about how all of these things are interconnected. So our report covers much more than just the weaponry and the equipment, but about other things that are very concerning with militarization, and in particular, how this is really, as you had discussed earlier in the show, all about what I think is, by all objective measures, a failure with regard to the war on drugs. Drugs are just as easy to find, just as cheap to find as they have ever been. We really need to change the way we think about drugs in this country and how it should be less of a law enforcement problem and more of a public health problem. And that's where all of this militarization springs out of, is this war on drugs. So I think a lot of people have recognized over the years that the war on drugs is a failure, but the response by our government and our elected officials seems to be to double down with the bad ideas.
Chief Jacobs, is that your sense about it? I mean, the war on drugs, even the idea of a war on something like drugs and drug use has been criticized a lot in recent years for just not working. But there's, once again, we're back to that semantics, that it's a war and it's a war against really the people that are out there and that you serve.
I would just say that, first of all, we enforce the laws that legislators, and you know, create. Mm-hmm. So at some point in time, the public asked legislators, or legislators decided to create the laws that we then are enforcing.
Yeah, the war on drugs. That phrase didn't come from law enforcement.
No, not at all.
Right.
And certainly you hear the public. I mean, you know, we had a first lady that was, you know, just don't do it. You know, and so. We take, you know, direction from the politicians that say, fight this crime. And certainly sometimes we're graded, and, you know, the expectations of the community are that we enforce those laws as well. So I think that we need to be careful about who to blame. And certainly I agree. I mean, we still have a lot of drugs that's present, and people are dying every day, weekly, due to overdoses that happen because of the availability of drugs. We make arrests all the time for drugs. We do a great job of enforcing those laws, but it's still not done. It is a societal issue, and society's going to have to figure out what they want to do about people that are using, are addicted, and how to get them well, and to get the need or the desire or the demand for those drugs out of here so that we don't have so many people dying of drugs.
What about the connection that Gary Daniels made between militarization of police forces and the war on drugs?
Well, I certainly think that it's important that we pay attention and listen to what people are asking for. We actually just, one of our tests for our upper level management was to read the book Rise of the Warrior Cop. We want everybody to be aware of the perception that the community may have about how we do our jobs in that militaristic fashion. There are definitely times when I believe that we need to come in full force and you know, be able to overcome whatever weapons are thrown at our direction. But that is not the way to do everyday policing. Mm-hmm. And we don't do it that way. We wear our regular uniforms, our regular white hats, and we go about our business in a very community-oriented policing way.
In a time of crisis like what's occurred in Ferguson, at that time, is that the time to wear the regular blues, or is that the time to put on the black jumpsuits? Right when you're trying to, at the worst possible time, what do you turn to?
You know, we have a very good policy here in Columbus of when people want to protest, we talk to them. And we say, what are you trying to accomplish? You know, what do you want to do? Where do you want to be? How do you want to do it? Do you want anybody to get arrested? And frequently the protest leaders will say, you know, these five people over here have volunteered to be arrested, and we'll explain what they have to do. They have to break the law to get arrested. And then we facilitate that if they do indeed break the law. But we try to work with our protesters. We protect people's First Amendment rights to, you know, protest. But we also know that there are people that take advantage of protest situations to do criminal behavior. And so it's always trying to figure out which ones are the criminals and which ones are the protesters and how to keep them separated, identified. The type of equipment that we wear, bring in, mm-hmm. and garb, is extremely important to that. And we realize that many people view that type of garb as provocative. So we are always constantly doing that. But we also know that if you let something continue to fester and don't take charge of the situation, that it can grow out of control. The more people in a crowd, the more mob behavior you get. And even people that wouldn't normally do some bad things do, because they're in the middle of something. And that goes for the reverse as well. You know, people that normally might have called the police won't call the police because of feeling that somebody else should do it. So we're very much aware of that. We're paying attention to that and listening to what our community wants us to do.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest, Gary Daniels from the ACLU, Columbus Division of Police Chief Kim Jacobs, and also Michael Berzer, criminologist and director of the School of Community Affairs at Wichita State University. 614-292-8513 is the number to call. And let's hear from Harry in Columbus. Hi, Harry.
Hello. Yeah, my comment is this process has been going along a long time before the 1033 program. I can recall back, I believe it was the late 70s, we had a sheriff here in Franklin County, Bo Smith, whose desire was to acquire an Army half-track vehicle. It's commonly used in the Second World War. It's a vehicle with tank treads on the drive wheels and then regular truck wheels on the front.
Mm-hmm.
And most notably, it was equipped with a 50 caliber machine gun. Now, my question to the panelists, and particularly to the police chief there, is whether or not she thinks that there is ever a situation where it would be appropriate for the Columbus Department of Police to use a 50 caliber machine gun in Franklin County or the city limits of Columbus.
Well, I certainly hope not. We believe that those are the types of weapons that the military should have, and generally the military does not do policing within our country. We haven't heard of a situation that would require such weaponry to be used.
Gary Daniels, there's an incredible array of weaponry that's come through the 1033 program and other, in other ways too, grenade launchers, things like that. I kind of wondered, why in the world would police ever use a grenade launcher?
Well, I think for a lot of police across the country, it amounts to, who doesn't like free stuff? I mean, here you have things you can be getting from the military.
What I saw was a lot of the police organizations that took a lot of that kind of stuff were less, they had
budgets.
Less money. They had smaller budgets, right.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems for a lot of these police departments, according to our study and what we've seen around Ohio, is that the justification comes when you're filling out the paperwork with regard to the war on drugs, maybe sometimes some terrorism, and then it's used for things that are dramatically different once they arrive in the local cities and the counties. In a time, I'll say, when violent crime and crimes of all types have been going down for decades. So law enforcement keeps coming up with these ways where they talk about how they could potentially use it in a country that's getting much safer. And I'll say, I'm not you know, there's a certain amount of blame to go around with elected officials who have been providing little to no oversight at all levels with this. But I'm not ready to let law enforcement off the hook entirely with this. In this country, as I think you and a lot of your listeners know, if you're black in this country, whether it's in Ohio or anywhere else in the country, and the stats hold across the board no matter where you are, if you're black, you're more likely to get stopped by police. You're more likely to get searched by police. You're more likely to get arrested by police. You're more likely to get convicted by police. And if you are convicted, you will spend a longer time in jail or prison than your white counterparts. And that's what we're seeing with a lot of this equipment, this paramilitary issue, where it's manifesting itself is much more in minority communities than we're seeing it. You know, you're much likely, more likely to see these types of things deployed in inner city neighborhoods than you are, for instance, in Upper Arlington or Bexley. And it's not because drug use is any different in those communities. It's because of where we choose to use our resources.
True, but I'm not passing any judgment on this when I say that if that's where the protests are occurring, and where they become violent versus in Upper Arlington, mm-hmm. Where they're not protesting much, isn't that part of the equation?
This issue is much, much bigger than Ferguson. I think Ferguson is just what have allowed people to... I think it's where the realization has finally kicked in, where they saw how police were conducting themselves and the equipment that they were using with the result of the protests. But this is something that's been going on well before anybody ever heard of Ferguson and will be going on well after. So I understand that people want to concentrate on what's going on in a particular part of the country, mm-hmm. but this is an issue across the nation.
Michael Berzer, any thoughts about that?
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, from a, if you look at a police, again, operational standpoint, you know, they're going to deploy officers in areas of the community where they're seeing, you know, higher types of particularly violent crime. And that's where you get the strained relationships with many communities, particularly communities of color, because the police are in those areas. So it's kind of a, you know, a darn if they do and darn if they don't, because there are an awful lot of citizens, and I know based on my own work in minority communities, that, you know, they want the police there. But then you have another faction that, you know, don't want the police in their communities, but oftentimes those are the communities that really have a lot of violent types of crimes and crimes that are more out in the open than you would find maybe in the suburbs. So, yeah, you know, it's a difficult position for the police to be in. I would agree with, you know, Gary Daniels that, yeah, I mean, if you're a black male, you're going to, you know, you're potentially going to get stopped in this country more so. And my research certainly has bore that out. But there's a lot of factors, I think, and that becomes the crux. And some of my work looks at racial profiling. There's just so many variables we've got to try to control for, and we're still trying to get a handle on how do we effectively do that and establishing benchmarks and that. But I'm not saying that it doesn't occur. I'm just saying that it's very difficult to measure that.
Chief Jacobs, I don't know if that is the case in Columbus. I did not look at that. But what do you make of the studies that have been pretty much unrefuted at this point about the racial profiling, about the not necessarily racial profiling, but the that a black male, young black male is more likely to be pulled over, to be arrested, to be convicted and serve more time?
I have read those numbers and all of that. I don't know what the numbers are for gender.
Mm-hmm.
Are they disproportionate for gender as well? And as Mr. Berzer said, there's a lot more to know than just the numbers. It's statistics, and they don't tell the story of why this stop occurred. Now, I will say that I can't say that racial profiling doesn't happen. I don't believe that it's a big problem here in Columbus. We don't have a way of determining what the motive of an officer was, just like we can't prevent somebody from feeling that that was the motive. But if there was a traffic violation, then the stop on itself is justified. If there was a violation of law, then we're allowed to and expected to stop people for that. And very, very often, we have absolutely no idea who is driving the car before we walk up to the driver's window. So there's a lot of factors involved in that. I believe that it does need to be researched more. I believe that it's a perception, at least, if not a reality, that needs to be worked on. I don't want people thinking that our officers profile them, because that does not go well for community relations. So I want research to happen, but it has to be something that takes into account all of those different things. and get to the bottom of that. But knowing what's going on in somebody's head or their feelings of being stopped for that reason are very difficult to determine.
I want to go to Tina now in Bexley and talk about that issue of, you know, when to shoot, when not to shoot, and where to shoot. Tina, you're on the air. Hi.
You know, I started to hang up because Gary, I think that's his name, Gary?
Yeah, Gary Daniels.
The points that he made were just spot on. Now, I just heard the chief of police say that she didn't really think that there was a problem in Columbus, Ohio with racial profiling.
Mm-hmm. Well,
where has she been? That's from, you know, that's absolutely scary to hear the chief of police make such a ludicrous assumption like that.
Okay, so but I thought you were going to talk about whether police are trained to shoot to injure, to
right.
injure, not to kill.
And you covered so much in the past 30 minutes, I don't even know where to begin. Let me ask you a question. When a person, let's just say, hypothetically, sells marijuana, and he gets busted, as he should, but if they really wanted to get a handle on crime, these black people are not growing marijuana in their backyards because usually they live
okay,
in apartments.
Okay, Tina, I don't mean to interrupt you. We're running out of time. I just kind of want, did you have a question for the you know, Chief Jacobs?
I have many questions, but one of my main concerns is when you bring military tanks in from Iraq, it's always in the black neighborhoods. It never happens in the suburbs. It never happens to white people. And then you don't understand why people protest, because they don't know what else to do.
Okay. All right. Thanks a lot, Tina. Appreciate it. She sounded very frustrated. Chief Jacobs, Gary Daniels, you cover that frustration in the new report. Michael Berzer, you study it as a criminologist at Wichita State University. It's complicated.
Can I, Chief Jacobs? I'd just like to respond. First of all, she asked where I've been. I've been with the Division of Police for almost 35 years, and I worked in internal affairs for 4 years. So I see the complaints that come in from our community, and we review those, and we have very few allegations of racial profiling. So I base that on what I actually have something to review and to see and to determine from. So I'm not denying that it might exist. I'm just saying that we have very few reported problems here in Columbus. With regard to the other statement, we don't have tanks. We have armored vehicles that we use with our SWAT team to go into.
What's the difference between an armored vehicle and a tank, though?
A tank is a weapon.
I don't know.
A tank is a weapon
okay.
that can destroy a house by shooting a projectile into it.
An armored vehicle is not a weapon.
It is protect the people that are inside so that they can approach a hostage barricade situation and perhaps help get the hostages out and deal with the suspect. To protect our officers, we can't send them in without protection and expect them to go in there day after day or after air barricade. And those happen across the city. They do not happen just in minority neighborhoods.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll return to our conversation. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Images of armored vehicles and assault weapons in Ferguson, Missouri have raised questions about whether our local police forces are too militarized. Law enforcement officials have said the equipment is a just-in-case measure to combat terrorism and drug trafficking on the local level. But others worry it's gone too far. Still with us by phone, Michael Berzer, criminologist from the Wichita State University, Kim Jacobs, chief of the Columbus Division of Police, and Gary Daniels. He's chief lobbyist for the Ohio chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union. The American Civil Liberties Union just put out a national report on the militarization of police forces in the United States. 614-292-8513 is the number to call if you have a question or comment. I'm going to turn to Kenneth now. You wanted to talk about armored vehicles. Hi, Kenneth.
Hey, how are you doing?
Fine, thank you.
Hi, Ann. My name is Kenneth Noiswater, and Chief Jacobs already explain that we don't drive tanks out there. They're not to blow up the armored personnel carriers. And your gentleman that you have on the phone there, we're making the assumption there that they're only in the black communities, which is absolutely wrong. We send them out all throughout the city. But we don't have as many homicides in Upper Arlington as you say in the Linden area. So you see us more prevalent out into the Linden area because of all the high crime, the homicides, the shootings, the daily shootings that go on out there. We have to be ready to respond to that. And for them to make the assumption that it's only out there in the black community because we're targeting blacks is absolutely ludicrous. It is wrong. And they need to strap on a gun and a bulletproof vest and go out there and work the streets and open up their eyes. How about that, Ian?
Okay. Kenneth, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Take care. David in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, David.
Hi. I think there's absolutely no place for military weapons. There needs to be more community relations built. Citizens need to work with the police, and building that kind of relationship is critical because citizens can help police. If citizens see the police as adversaries, then they don't help them. And I think military hardware creates this aggressor feeling where you see the police as the aggressor rather than they're the guys that help me out and solve police problems.
And Michael Berzer, is that what you were talking about when you said it exacerbates the problems?
Yes, it does. And there's a clear line of research that tends to indicate that when you use those tactics, particularly in minority communities that are already strained relationships, that does just that, exacerbates the situation. And I agree with the caller that, yeah, we need to get back to the principles of community-oriented policing, which we have tended to kind of walk away from here in years past. But that whole philosophy, that strategy of the way we operate, was based on crime prevention, partnerships with the community, problem-solving, working with the community, and then the organizational transformation issues that have to happen within the agency, the cultural things that have been around for many years, addressing those to see if they still fit with where we want to go with contemporary policing.
I have a couple emails now I want to read. And by the way, David, thank you for your call. An email from John. Militarization, he says, is a positive to me. Our military seems to be one of the few units of government that is effective. I'm proud of our military. I want our police force to have overwhelming power. Those officers have a dangerous job. They should have the best we can offer them. An email from Jim in Grandview along the same lines writes, I don't understand the concerns over the police use of rifles, whether automatic or otherwise. I can certainly see circumstances where a rifle would be appropriate. Think of a school hallway, which can easily be longer than the accurate range of a handgun. Similarly, a helicopter would be a much better alternative to a high-speed chase by patrol vehicles. The idea of militarization, then, for some people, isn't troublesome. Gary Daniels, what is your response to that?
Look, there are some situations where the levels of force and equipment that we're talking about, I don't know that anybody would object to. And we're talking about very serious, specific situations. The problem is when mission creep sets in. And this seems to be what always happens with regard to this.
And mission creep being?
Mission creep being you have something designed for an initial specific purpose, but then you find different ways to use and utilize it beyond its original means. And let's talk about SWAT teams, for instance. They were created basically as paramilitary entities in the late 1960s, and they had specific duties in mind when they were created, and that's with active shooters and barricades and hostage situations. The power that we give them, the equipment they use, we decided as a society and among our elected officials should be for limited purposes. But as our report reveals, and this is the government's own documents, this isn't ACLU speculation or anything, SWAT, what we found in the documents we got is that only in 7% of situations were they used for active shooter, barricade, and hostage situations. 79% of the time, they're used to execute search warrants. And when they come in full-blown military gear with flashbang grenades and no-knock warrants and battering rams, and what you find is people getting shot, people getting killed, pets getting shot, kids being hurt. These are all situations that we detail in our report. What you find is, again, in a society that's getting safer, where crime is going down, where a majority of people acknowledge that the war on drugs has been a failure, we keep ramping up our level of law enforcement and the capabilities that we get them. And something is severely out of whack with that way of thinking and the way that we've approached these problems.
Chief Jacobs, are you comfortable with the email from John? Militarization is a positive to me, and that he wants you to have overwhelming power.
There are definitely times when we need to have power that is greater than what we're facing, and that needs to be used judiciously. We can't bring it in every single time, but there are definitely times when if we don't overwhelm with the power that we have, with the force that we have, with the equipment that we have, with just the numbers that we might have, our community could suffer. So we believe that being prepared is necessary, certainly. And with regard to crime going down, I can't disagree that in general, crime has gone down. But I can also tell you that we take guns off the street all the time. In the last 2 weeks, we've submitted more than 100 guns to our property room. In the last 2 weeks.
2 weeks.
There are guns everywhere. Our officers are confronting people with guns all the time. So even though crime might be down, or at least reported crime might be down, there are a lot of people that are armed out in our community, driving around, walking around, that are armed. And our officers face them every single day. And it's through our training and our equipment, but mostly our training, because they aren't wearing any extra equipment other than what we've routinely equipped them with. They're dealing with those situations effectively. And I think that we have to understand, and our community needs to understand, that they are facing dangerous situations every single day.
Do you have a sense from your work as a police officer for many years now and as chief, and you get around the country and you know what people are talking about, when someone dons a black jumpsuit and that, you know, they slap the SWAT on the side of their arm and they take on one of these big rifles, or they get behind an armored, you know, inside an armored vehicle, does that change how they approach their job?
I think that if that stuff goes on, that means that they're getting ready for an operation. And certainly you want them to be attentive during a situation like that. But SWAT doesn't get rolled out very often. Yes, indeed, they are used for serving dangerous search warrants where we have information that this person might be armed, because we want to prevent that thing. And it's through our training and through our experience that we're able to minimize injuries. And luckily, we have a lot of situations that are resolved very peacefully.
John Kirby, Department of Defense spokesman, said in a statement that once the equipment is handed over from the federal government, and I'm just interested in your perspective as a police chief of a big city in the United States, it is up to the local police forces to determine how to use it. Should that be the case necessarily? Should there be a training program or an agency that oversees the use of that equipment?
Fortunately, in Ohio, all of the things that we do are public record. Mm-hmm. And so if anybody wants to know what we're doing, they have access to that. And oversight, in my opinion, is always necessary.
Some of these smaller departments don't have the same kind of oversight. They certainly don't have the resources. That's why a lot of them are taking the equipment, because they aren't going to get anything any other way.
Correct.
But they're not necessarily getting training to go with it.
No, that would be the responsibility of the chief of police or whoever, the sheriff, whoever might be acquiring that.
Darren in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Darren.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
I just wanted to bring up the point that we can talk about the militarization of the cops, and we could talk about all these other things, but the reason that I think there's such a distrust in the African community with police is because when things like this happen with Mike Brown and Crawford and Ezell Ford, we get away from the point that three unarmed men have been killed in their neighborhoods, and we start talking about militarization of the police. We talk about Mike Brown stealing from the store, which none of that has to do with why, if none of that happened, there will be no protest, there will be no need for the militarization of the police.
In other words, there wouldn't have been a protest to show up with in the first place.
Right. If there was action taken against Darren Wilson or any of these officers, not even just these isolated incidents, going back to Amadou Diallo and Sean Bell, how can we as black people trust the police to take action against somebody when a principle has already been set that you can shoot a black man 50 times, 40 times, 8 times, 10 times with witnesses around and nothing's going to happen? I mean, how long are we supposed to take that? And then once it happens and we protest, they bring in tanks.
Darren, I assume you're African-American, right?
Yes.
You know, Chief Jacobs, this is how Darren feels. I'm sure he's speaking for a lot of people about how they feel. You can't change how people feel, or can you? Do you see a problem out there regardless?
I truly believe that you can change how people feel through education and making sure that we have all the facts out on the table.
Are you frustrated, though, that you walk into your office every day and there's people out there who are afraid of you?
Oh, absolutely. And we deal with that on a regular basis. That's why I mentioned community policing. I mean, we have great community policing in Columbus. We have community liaison officers that deal with all of the community, neighborhood associations, civic associations, block watches, and we're available to them all the time and to answer their questions, to give them the facts, to deal with some of the issues that they have.
Michael Berzer, another issue that's come up, you know, lots of issues have come up through this issue, through what's happened, the events in Ferguson, Missouri, but one of them has been the diversity or lack thereof of the police force. Is that something that's reflected, something that's echoed across the country as well?
Absolutely. It depends on, you know, where you're at in the agency. But yes, the police department has to represent or reflect the community that they serve. And, you know, when you go into a community like Ferguson or any other community and you have a fairly substantial minority population and you have an all-white police department, something's wrong there. I think oftentimes what you have are police departments set back and expect minority applicants to come to them to apply. That's not the case. You've got to get out, market your recruiting and selection strategies, and target your audience, because most of the time there's so much distrust there that they're not going to come in to you and fill out an application. So you've got to get out there and market and target them. And that's been the case with several police departments that I've worked with here recently, and that's been problematic. And when they start to do that, on recruiting literature, little things, symbolic things like the recruiting literature, mm-hmm. ensuring that that reflects diversity, that you have black officers, Hispanic officers, and females, as opposed to all white male officers on the recruiting brochure.
Right.
You know what that's going to get you. You're not going to get one applicant.
And thanks to Darren,
so, yeah,
by the way, for that call.
It is an issue.
Yeah, thanks to Darren, by the way, for that call. Chief Jacobs, that was something we talked about when you first, when you were named appointed chief, and there hasn't been a lot of success with that, probably a big frustration. What have you learned about the problems, Erin?
Well, certainly, I totally agree that we need to reflect our community. I believe that that builds trust in the community, seeing people that look like them. And I became a police officer through recruiting. And I hadn't thought about law enforcement prior to that because I didn't see women in policing in the 70s. They weren't visible. And so we have to make our minority underrepresented groups visible to our community so that they know that this is something that they can do. And then our whole focus of recruiting has been to get the people that aren't already interested, to go to the people that haven't thought about this job and say, have you thought about law enforcement?
And what have you learned about that? Or what are they telling you? Is it people like Darren who's like, heck no, I mean, I don't want to join a force I don't trust?
And to me, that's the way that you make change. I will say that one of the reasons why policing has changed is because we've become more diverse. Women have been in law enforcement now for about 40 years. That has made a change in law enforcement. Less homogeneous groups and more diversity makes us have better perspective, a wider range of perspective and views.
We just have about 30 seconds left, but Gary Daniels, does diversity play into this at all from where you sit?
Well, I think it does, but I think it's a very complicated issue. It's mm-hmm. more than just about the wording of brochures or doing some outreach. There's been distrust among communities of color with police for decades now, and I think what happens with a lot of police departments is they do a certain amount of outreach, then they look at their very next recruiting class, and they say, oh, well, you know, where are all these people of color that we tried to recruit? This must have been a big failure, we're going to roll back our efforts. This is not something that's going to be solved in the next year, the next 5 years, or the next decade. What we're talking about is decades worth of bad relations between certain communities and police for a variety of reasons, and it becomes very understandable why people from those communities then don't want to become police. But we're looking at this too short term when we need to be looking at it more long term.
Well, I, for one, plan on having more conversations about it. And Gary Daniels, I want to thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Ann.
Gary Daniels, chief lobbyist for the American Civil Liberties Union of Ohio. Also, Kim Jacobs, chief of the Columbus Division of Police. Thanks so much for joining us
today. Thank you.
And Michael Berzer, professor of criminal justice and director of the School of Community Affairs at Wichita State University. Michael, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ann.
Thanks to everybody for listening. Thanks for the calls. Thanks for the emails. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Morning Edition on 89.7 NPR News